The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
It's going to be thiazides. And so we're throwing thiazides at patients since they're such an effective blood pressure medication. And I think it's under-recognized how much hyponatremia comes from that.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call is based on an article titled Hyponatremia in the Clinic. Joining us on the podcast is Dr. Joel Toff, who's a clinical nephrologist in Detroit. In 2017, he won the Robert G. Nairns Award from the American Society of Nephrology for innovative use of social media and electronic communication in nephrology education. He's well known as a podcaster and a frequent guest on podcasts, and we're happy to have him join us to have this discussion of outpatient hyponatremia. Joel, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. I've talked to you many times in the past about sodium, and I know that you love the topic of hyponatremia. So I thought that this would be a good time for us to talk about what we do with hyponatremia in the outpatient setting, and then what do we do with hyponatremia in the inpatient setting? So I'm sure you get consults from primary care physicians all the time. This guy's got hyponatremia. What should we do? So let's just break it down to at what sodium do you get concerned that it's enough that you're going to try to figure out with the primary care physician what's going on?
Yeah, right. So that's a good question. And what I would say is that the question, I think anybody, once you start seeing sodiums in the 120s, everybody gets alarmed. And I don't think there's any question you're going to address that, maybe even send the patient to the emergency department to get that evaluated. I feel pretty comfortable with that, with stating that. Maybe there's some edge cases at 128. But I think the harder one is the asymptomatic patient has a sodium of 133. Right? It feels like, what am I chasing after? It just seems like a lab abnormality. The patient has normal mentation, normal cognition. And what I would say is, if you look epidemiologically, even in that range, you're going to see increased falls, increased osteopenia and osteoporosis, so decreased bone mineral density at those levels of sodium. And if you do careful studies, you can see abnormal cognition. And so those sodiums in the 130s that seem innocuous can be problematic. Now, the piece of data that I wish I could tell you that I don't have is I can't tell you, do you improve their mineralization if you bring their sodium up to 136 or 137? We don't have that data. And I think that's an important piece. Now, the cognition, we have done some studies, at least short term, that showing raising up their sodium in short term does improve performance on like a Montreal cognition test. And so that to me seems like, you know, people care about how well they think. If you talk about patients, what are they most concerned about? Dementia and loss of cognition is super important. And I think, and the reason I bring up dementia is because we tend to see this in older patients, that if you look at like NHANES data, ambulatory patients, as people get older, they get more and more hyponatremia. It becomes more and more common.
When you get involved,
yeah,
what are the usual causes of the hyponatremia? So what are the things that should be on our checklist in clinic when someone comes in with sodium? Let's do 133 between 130 and 133 first, and then go down to the 120s.
Sure. Yeah. So the big one is going to be thiazides. And so we're throwing thiazides at patients. They're such an effective blood pressure medication, and I think it's under-recognized how much hyponatremia comes from that. One of the things that I saw, there's a beautiful study came out of Great Britain, and actually hyponatremia was more common than hypokalemia with the initiation of a thiazide, which kind of surprised me. About 14% of patients were developing hyponatremia. It was like 8% getting hypokalemia. So very common. That drug is, mixed in with all the ARBs. We've seen that a lot. So that's the first thing I would look at. And then the next one would be SSRIs. And that's another common side effect. And it's really going to be all of your antidepressants, really across the board. They all cause hyponatremia. Some of them more commonly than others. Fluoxetine tends to be a little bit lower percentage. Mirtazapine is actually also the SNRIs have lower rates of hyponatremia. And so those would be, you could possibly think about flipping to one of those, but it generally is a class effect. If it's in one SSRI, it'll be in the other SSRIs, though there is some slight variation from drug to drug. So those would be, and then you gotta think about heart failure and cirrhosis being the other two things that can be driving that hyponatremia.
So I was very encouraged because those are the things that I discuss with my teams. But I don't know this, and maybe you know the answer, maybe you don't. So does it matter what thiazide you're using? So for example, a lot of us are going to chlorothalidone for longer duration and better blood pressure control compared to hydrochlorothiazide. Does that change your probability of getting hyponatremia?
So the big studies have not differentiated. So the big epidemiologic studies have just thrown them at that. My sense is when I switch people from HCTZ to chlorothalidone, it's a sneaky dose increase that I just keep them on the 25 milligrams, which is essentially a doubling of the effective dose. And when you do that, you see about a doubling of their hyponatremia. So I just think it's the effectiveness of the drug. I don't think there's a difference, and it has not been reported as a finding there.
Okay. So the heart failure and cirrhosis are very interesting because they're going to overlap with our inpatient thing, but I think it's worthwhile for people to understand the importance of hyponatremia. First in heart failure and then in cirrhosis, why those that is a big red flag in your mind?
Right. Well, I mean, the concern here is that any disease that then causes hyponatremia has a much worse outcome. So you have a heart failure patient, and then they're developing hyponatremia from that heart failure. Those patients have significantly worse mortality or rates of hospitalization. They're just much sicker. And it's not hard to wrap your mind around that. Just, think about the disease is so profound that it is breaking homeostasis, the ability for us to maintain our relationship with sodium and water. And that's a pretty foundational problem. When the body can no longer maintain, at homeostasis, you're headed for badness. And so, and that goes across kind of all diseases. And we see this, hyponatremia kind of regardless of what's associated with, it has worse outcomes. These patients do worse. Is that what you were thinking about, or was there something else that you wanted to address?
Yeah, so I know the data. Back when I was an intern in 1975, we knew that hyponatremia was a big risk factor for death in heart failure. We didn't know that for cirrhosis till more recently.
Yeah,
Is there anything you can
same
do about
issue.
it? So what do you advise when they have hyponatremia? Can we approach that in some way? Or is this just their end stage and there's not much we can do?
Right, so probably, I hate to be depressing here, but there's a trial, I don't know, 15 years ago called the Everest trial, which was a trial of tolvaptan in heart failure. So patients were enrolled when they had decompensated heart failure, but it wasn't an acute heart failure study. It was a chronic heart failure study. They were continued on the tolvaptan for months, years afterwards, hoping that bringing their sodium up would help. And there was a small signal in the patients that were hyponatremic that it was beneficial. But in general, blocking vasopressin with a small molecule like that didn't change the trajectory of the heart failure. Maybe, like in some subgroups, there may have been some improvement, but I do kind of think it's more of an epiphenomena, and that fixing the sodium if it's, you know, if it's mild, there is not going to change the trajectory of your heart failure. I think what you really have there is heart failure that's so profound that your body no longer can maintain homeostasis of sodium and water, and that's just a bad sign.
But if you could improve the heart failure, the 100%. Sodium could correct.
That right, but again, there you want to be focusing on the heart failure, and the sodium is just an epiphenomenon. Yeah, if you right. can fix the heart failure, absolutely, that's what you want to do. And in fact, that's how we go about treating hyponatremia and heart failure. Generally, we say, well, let's get them compensated, let's give them loop diuretics, and what you watch the sodium get better as the heart failure improves.
And similarly, in cirrhosis, that's now a trigger if they're a candidate for liver transplant.
Yeah, it's part of the score. That's exactly yeah. right. Yeah.
Back to the medications. Is it as simple as changing the medications, stopping the hydrochlorothiazide? Does that fix things the majority of the time?
If you have the right diagnosis, I think it really does. Yeah. I think we need to be careful here. Like, mental health is a profound disease and has real morbidity and mortality. And if you have a patient who has found the right medications to keep them stable from their mental health, and you're comparing that to a sodium of 133, I think you ought to be careful and thoughtful before stopping that medication, right? Because we don't have any evidence that improving that sodium is going to improve those concerns that we had about mm-hmm. osteoporosis and falls into cognition, some data on cognition, but I would be nervous if you had a stable patient, you know, and I see this a lot, people with pretty profound mental health diseases that you're like, you know what, I'm going to tolerate this degree of hyponatremia because I don't want to deal with the problems of severe mental health decompensation.
I've read some of the articles about falls and mental status and balance issues with hyponatremia, but I personally have not found one that says that as the sodium goes down, it gets worse and worse and worse. Are you aware of any such studies, or is that just something that you clinically have seen?
I am not sure of the dose response there. My gut is the worse the hyponatremia, the worse that cognition and falls is. But I'm not certain. I'm not absolutely certain on that. It's a good question.
Yeah, I'd like to know that exactly for the reason that you just discussed. When you have that patient whose depression is doing much better on an SSRI, and now their sodium is 133, should I be worried? Might not be worried at 133, would I be worried at 128?
Right.
Would you be worried?
Well, what I would say is that epidemiologically, we find a signal for increased fractures and decreased bone mineralization even at 133.
Right.
That this is biologically active even in these very mild, what I would consider insignificant cases of hyponatremia. I'm concerned about it, and yes, we'd be more concerned about it at 128. But I think at 128, you're starting to think about other issues, and you're more concerned about it and more apt to make a move.
Let me ask you one more outpatient question, one more area in the outpatient. And then we'll break that off, and then we'll have a separate set of questions about inpatient. We often discharge people from the hospital who have chronic hyponatremia. And now I have to take care of them in the office, so to speak. And so let's say it's somebody who really has SIDH, and maybe you can just discuss those patients, and what do you do for those patients who chronically, you know, they presented me somebody at Morningport the other day who always runs at 125. I said, you can't let him always run at 125. I said, no matter what we do, it goes back down to 125. So, you know, they've done everything in the hospital. Now they're back to you, and you're stuck with someone who's running in the 120s to 130s. How do you follow them, and is there anything you can do?
Okay, so what we've seen is a few different products come on the U.S. market, medical foods of urea, and these are probably our most effective tool for treating SIADH. And so you'll want to prescribe them, and I usually start at 15 grams a day, but you can do 15 grams twice a day. And these medications, along with fluid restriction, will help your hyponatremia. They are an effective therapy. They're not a fast therapy, but you don't need fast in the outpatient, right? You just want 1 or 2 points a day or a week is going to be fine as long as we're going north. And so, the downside of these medications is they don't, you mix up the urea and it doesn't taste good. And though they're not expensive when you think about modern pharmaceuticals, they generally aren't covered by insurance and they're going to be $100 a month or so. And for a number of, for some patients that's fine, and for other patients that's untenable. And so, but that's the first thing that I reach for, and all these patients that I have at home are taking urea if they have SIADH. So that's the first step. And then the other tool that you can use is SGLT2 inhibitors, right? It's not a large effect, but it is a definite effect. They're going to bump their sodium by 2 or 3 points when you use an SGLT2 inhibitor. I wouldn't go with the low doses. I would try to maximize as much osmotic diuresis as you can, because that osmotic diuresis is another way to increase water excretion by the kidney, right? And that's going to help drive up the sodium. And so, use your empagliflozin, use your dapagliflozin, sorry, I missed that one. Your dapagliflozin, go with 25 and 10, not your 10 and 5 that we often use for heart failure. Go to the higher doses and try to maximize that. And then the last thing, especially if they have concentrated urine, get that urine osmolalities north of 800, try a loop diuretic on those patients. So the loop diuretics can help, it prevents them from concentrating their medullary interstitium. And if they can't concentrate their medullary interstitium, even in the presence of vasopressin, their urine osmolality is not going to get so high. And so that's another way that you can kind of change the game.
Now, is this mostly a palliative care thing? Are most of these people who have really bad chronic SIADH also being treated by the oncologist?
The bad SIADH, you see them in a couple of different things. So that's clearly some of them is the patients that have, untreatable or kind of palliative care malignancies. But sometimes you just get into tight spots. Patient with a bad trigeminal neuralgia, they're using some of these SSRIs and other medications to control that. Or patients with bad mental health disease, they're required to be on antipsychotics that are driving the SIADH, and you're not going to be able to stop those medications, and you're just trying to manage around this condition. So it's not only malignancy, you see it in other situations also.
Well, Joel, thank you very much for this discussion of the outpatient problems that we see with hyponatremia, and we'll have you back on soon to discuss the inpatient problems.
Excellent. Thanks for having me here. This is delightful.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This fascinating discussion focused just on outpatient hyponatremia. To me, one of the most interesting things about this is that we underestimate the dangers of even sodiums as the level of 133, and certainly lower. We had a long discussion of what those problems are. Negative for bones, it's negative for nutrition, it's negative for cognition, and is actually a risk factor for falls. The other thing that was important was the important role of thiazides as a risk factor in office practice, as well as many psychiatric drugs, especially SSRIs. We should all pay attention to sodiums, even at the level of 133 and certainly anything below, and ask ourselves, is there something we can do to stop a medication that's causing that, or if it's not a medication, to wonder why that's happening? We did have a long discussion of heart failure and cirrhosis as causes, and we should be aware of those also. Thank you for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.